The Kevin Smith Show, unique in the galaxy.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful planet we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Some of you are joining us for the very first time. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here, and I hope you make a habit out of it, good habit to get into. All week long, people have been sending me email talking about the fact that the French were supposed to make full disclosure about UFOs today. And I got some last week saying that it was going to happen last Friday, and then I got some this week saying it was going to happen today. Friday, both Fridays have come and gone, and so far as I know, the French government has made no statement about UFOs. It would have been wonderful, but it is as I expected it would be. We hear these things a lot, and we get our hopes up, and then nothing happens. So I don't know what the deal is with that. If it did happen, it's not being reported yet on any of the forums or sites that I check. And I check them on a daily basis, about 35 of them, and no one is reporting yet that the French have made disclosure. Now, I sent an email to a friend where we discussed that, and he said, well, yeah, but you know the time difference. Well, they're ahead of us. And so it is deep night time now. Very, very early morning on Saturday now in France. And so both Fridays have come and gone. And as I said, insofar as I have been able to ascertain, there was no statement by the French government about UFOs. So we'll keep our fingers crossed and hope that maybe they will. As I said, it turned out pretty much as I expected it would. Tonight is K-Files night. That means that tonight we begin sending the K-Files e-zine. Now, sometimes people panic. They hear me say that, and then by Saturday afternoon, they haven't received their K-Files e-zine. Well, it takes until Sunday for us to get the whole list sent, okay? So, hang in there. Over the weekend, you will get the K-Files e-zine. Some of you will get it starting tonight. It is our free weekly newsletter. And if you're not receiving the K-Files e-zine, you're not subscribed to it, well, you need to subscribe. If you were subscribed and you're not getting it, then very likely what happened was we tried to send you an issue, an edition of K-Files e-zine. It bounced back to us three times, and our software deleted your email address from our database. It does that on purpose so that we don't get accused of spamming. Once you get accused of spamming, life gets very, very difficult in terms of trying to send email to people. So to protect you against spamming and to protect ourselves against those accusations, we have it set up that way. So if you were getting it and you're not, resubscribe. And be sure when you get that confirmation email, you click the link. My guest this evening is known all over the world, Michael Cramo. And his book is known all over the world, Forbidden Archaeology. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Michael Cramo. Now, he has been with us before. It's been a very long time since we've had him on the show, and it is a delight to welcome him back. Michael Cramo, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're delighted you're here.
It's great to be with you, Kevin, and all your listeners again.
Your book has not lost any steam since we talked last. It's still going strong. Forbidden Archaeology is still really, really much in the minds and upon the conversation of a lot of our listeners. And you turned over some new ground. Well, I guess you turned over some very ancient ground with that book. And upset a lot of apple carts in the scientific world as well, I think. Your book and your studies, your research, your lectures, you talk about the human race being very, very old.
Yes, that's correct, Kevin. According to the standard theories, human beings like us first came into existence on Earth about 200,000 years ago. Most scientists today believe that before that time, there were no human beings like us on Earth. They believe there were only more primitive, ape-like human ancestors, like the Neanderthals, Homo erectus, Homo habilis, Australopithecus. They have lots of different names for these ape-like ancestors of the modern human species, and that is what you see in all the textbooks. But what I found when I looked into the whole history of archaeology is that there's a lot of evidence in the primary scientific literature that contradicts that idea. When I say primary scientific literature, I mean not the textbooks. The textbooks are secondary literature. They're based on original reports by original investigators. So I decided to look beyond the textbooks, look at the whole history of archaeology, look at the original reports in many different languages from archaeologists and anthropologists and geologists and paleontologists in all parts of the world. And when I did that, I was amazed to find that many of them were reporting finding human bones, human footprints, and human artifacts many, many millions of years old, sometimes tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of years old. So I began to think, well, if these things are in the original scientific literature and the primary scientific literature, why aren't they mentioned in the textbooks? And the only reason I could see that they weren't mentioned was because of what I call a process of knowledge filtration, whereby the discoveries that contradict the established theories are filtered out for one reason or another. So they never make it into the pages of the textbooks. That means the young scientists who are being trained in the universities, they never hear about this evidence. Students don't read about it in their textbooks. People won't hear scientists talking about it on television. If they go to the local museum, they won't see these discoveries, although they may be there, you know, somewhere in the museum collection. So that's why I called this kind of evidence forbidden archaeology. If we look at archaeology as a big museum, we would see that people are only let into one tiny little room of that museum, and there they only see the discoveries that support the current theories. But what I tried to do in my work is let people into the other rooms of that big museum of archaeology, rooms with locks on the doors, tried to take off those locks, let people see what's inside, and what we see are many discoveries of human skeletons, human footprints, and human artifacts going back tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years.
Well, isn't there supposed to be, I think I read this somewhere, I don't think I dreamed it, but isn't there supposed to be a fossilized human footprint that dates from around 3 billion years old?
The oldest footprint evidence that I documented in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, goes back about 500 or 600 million years. This is the footprint that was discovered by William Meister in the 1960s at a place called Antelope Springs in Utah. He was a fossil hunter. He was searching for fossils. He had his geologist hammer, and he was breaking open pieces of rock. And he broke open one piece of rock, and he saw in it a footprint, not actually a footprint of a bare foot, but a shoe print.
Mm-hmm.
And in the shoe print, he could see it had crushed a fossil called a trilobite. So a trilobite is a little shellfish that was characteristic of the geological period called the Cambrian period, which goes back about 500, 600 million years. And this footprint was exactly, well, the shoe print exactly, more properly speaking, the shoe print, not a footprint, but shoe print, was exactly like that of a shoe print that you might see of a person walking on a beach today. The heel was worn down in the appropriate place. It was exactly the shape of a modern human shoe print. And it was discovered in layers of rock about almost 600 million years old. Now, there's some other human footprints from Rock Castle, Kentucky, that I documented in my book, Forbidden Archaeology. Those footprints are prints of bare human feet, and they go back about 300 million years. There was also a recent case just this year, there was an interesting discovery. It doesn't go back 3 billion years. If you do have a report of human footprints that go back about 3 billion years, I certainly would want to learn about that.
I was just trying to remember, and it may have been 3 million years. But
yes, that could be. Mm-hmm. Well, that, if we're talking about 3 million years, it could be the Laetoli footprints. These were footprints that were discovered by Mary Leakey, who was one of the prominent archaeologists of the late 20th century. She was the wife of Louis Leakey, who was another very famous archaeologist, the mother of Richard Leakey, another famous archaeologist. But she, in her own right, was a very prominent archaeologist. And in 1979, she announced the discovery of footprints at a place called Laetoli in the country of Tanzania in East Africa. This wasn't just a single footprint. These were dozens of footprints arranged in three trails. So you had three different individuals walking. And these footprints were found in layers of solidified volcanic ash about 3 million years old, dated by the potassium-argon method. And in her original report, which was published in National Geographic magazine, Mary Leakey said that these footprints are indistinguishable from modern human footprints. They looked exactly like modern human footprints, and other scientists also agreed. Paleontologist Tim White wrote, make no mistake about it, these are exactly like modern human footprints. However, neither Mary Leakey nor Tim White believed that humans like us were present 3 million years ago to make those footprints. They were evolutionists. So according to their ideas, humans like us did not exist at that time. We had not evolved yet. So they proposed, well, there must have been, existing at that time, some kind of ape man who had feet exactly like modern human feet. Now, that's an interesting proposal, but there's no physical evidence to support that idea. We have the skeletons, the ape men, who existed at that time in Africa. They're called Australopithecus. We have the foot bones of those creatures. And the foot of Australopithecus is not like that of a modern human being. It's very ape-like, like the foot of a chimpanzee, for example, with very long toes and other ape-like features. Actually, the only creature known to science today that has a foot exactly like a modern human foot is a human being like us. So what did Mary Leakey actually find? I believe she found evidence that human beings like us were existing 3 million years ago in Africa.
Well, and on top of that, the footprint you told us about earlier, the shoe print from 600 million years ago, and they were wearing shoes. So that would indicate that they were somewhat technologically sophisticated.
Yes, there are some interesting indications like that. Not everything gets preserved in the layers of the earth. That's one unfortunate thing. It's not that everything that's been left by past civilizations gets preserved. You know, the metals generally oxidize, like iron will rust. Rust is a kind of oxidation. It means if you have some iron, it won't last very long. Other metals, most other metals oxidize, except for gold. Gold doesn't oxidize. At least it doesn't oxidize very easily, so it lasts a long time, and that's one of the reasons why gold is so valuable. That's why we place such a high value on gold. It's a rare mineral. It's a rare metal, but it also lasts a long time. That's why I think some of the very most ancient artifacts that have been found have been made of gold. Yeah, there was a case in 1892 where a woman named Mrs. Robert Culp was putting some coal into a coal-burning stove in her home in Morrisonville, Illinois, in the United States. And, you know, the piece of coal was too big, so she broke it open. And inside, she found a 10-inch gold chain, a very delicate gold chain, beautiful gold chain. And it wasn't something that had just dropped into her coal bucket because, as I said, she broke a big piece of coal in half And when she picked up the chain, both pieces of the coal were still hanging at either end of this chain. Now, from this report, which was published in the Morrisonville Times, we were able to determine what mine the coal came from. So we got in touch, my co-author and I, with geologists of the State Geological Survey of Illinois, and we asked, well, how old is the coal from this mine? And they told us about 300 million years. That's from before the time of the dinosaurs, even. So you do have this beautifully made gold chain, hundreds of millions of years old. There are also some interesting reports from miners. For example, early in the 20th century, miners at a place called Hivener, somebody corrected me on the pronunciation of that town in Oklahoma once. I originally called it Hevener because it's spelled like that, Heaven, E-R, Hevener. But they told me, somebody called me up on the radio and told me they pronounce it Hivener. So in Hivener, Oklahoma, there was a coal mine, and miners had gone down over a mile in this coal mine, and they had been using dynamite to blast out what they called rooms in the coal, and after they had blasted it, they would clear out the coal and send it up. So one day, after they had blasted out a room, as they called it, in this coal mine, they saw a wall made of blocks of stone about 6 inches square. And they said the stone was so polished that they could actually see their reflections. The miners could see their reflections in in the polished blocks of stone. So they reported this, and then they were taken out of the mine. I mean, this is reported by one of the miners named Atlas Mathis, and he was working in the number 5 coal mine near Hivener, and they, as I said, they had gone over a mile down beneath the surface of the earth, and that's where they encountered this stone wall, this amazing stone wall.
And then they were taken out of that area? They were not allowed to work in that area some more?
Yes, that's the report that was given by Atlas Mathis. They said when they mentioned this, the mine owners, the mine officials, took them out of the mine and shipped them off to another mine. So,
I want to explore that just a little bit before we get too far away from it. But we have a break coming up here in about 10 seconds. No, about 2 seconds. There it is. So we'll step away for this break. We'll be back right after this. More with Michael Cremo right after this break. Back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Michael Cremo. And Michael, when we went away for break, you had just mentioned about this coal mine where the miners found a wall made of small stones, blocks that were about 6 inches, I believe you said.
That's correct.
Highly polished. And then they were moved. Is there any record as to why or what that wall was all about?
All I really have is the report given by one of the miners. Now, I would really like to find out more about it, if it's at all possible. If there's anybody from that area that had relatives that were working at that time, it was in the year 1928 that this discovery took place. As I said, the miner who made the report was Atlas Alman Mathis, who had been working in the number 5 coal mine, about 2 miles north of Heavener, Oklahoma. So that's about as much information as I have, other than the details of the discovery that were reported.
Well, that sort of brings up the whole question of what's up with why the ubiquitous they don't want us to know about these ancient evidences of human existence on this planet. And let me throw this into the mix. There are giants that have been found, giant skeletons that have been found all over the United States. And as soon as they are reported, they were excavated by the Army. This would have been back in the 1800s. In some cases by the Smithsonian. And then these skeletons disappear. And if you go to the Smithsonian to ask them about them, they say they have no record of it, even though some documents have been found that corroborate that people they said never even worked for them on these projects. They said, we never had anybody with that name on the project, they never worked for us. And then documents have been found showing that they did indeed work for the Smithsonian. So what's the deal with causing the evidence to disappear from public sight?
You know, I call it knowledge filtration, but you're asking what's the reason for it. You know, and in some cases, there are a lot of different reasons for it, I believe. In some of these cases, like the discovery that was made in the mine and other discoveries that are made in the course of mining and construction activities, road building and things like that, it could be because when things like this are discovered, they're supposed to report them to the government, archaeological workers who then are supposed to go in and investigate, and in many cases, the companies that are engaged in the construction or road building activities or whatever, or mining activities, whatever they're doing, they have to pay, for the archaeological investigation, and they may have to cease their activities for some time. So this could be one reason why the evidence is covered up, but I think there are more reasons than that. That are related not to these commercial kinds of concerns, but to scientific concerns. There's a lot of kinds of power in the world. There's military power, economic power, political power. There's also intellectual power, which is a very subtle power, but a very real one. And, we kind of see that those who have power, in particular monopoly power, don't like to give it up. So for the past 100 years or so, the supporters of the current theories, evolutionary theories of human origins, have had a government-enforced monopoly in the education system and scientific institutions in this country and in many other countries around the world. So if you've got a monopoly position that only your ideas can be taught, you don't want to give up that position very easily. I think that it, and in another sense, you could say it's just human nature. For example, if I love somebody and someone tells me something bad about the person I love, I don't want to believe it. I may even become angry at the person who tells me. Similarly, many scientists today are very much in love with their theories. Just like this year is the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth. And
you know, it's a sad birthday, you know, because, I mean, we can say without hesitation now that Darwin is dead.
Right. Yeah, he's well on his way to becoming a fossil. I wish I could say the same about some of his ideas.
Well, they are, too, because of genetics. They've now determined, and a lot of scientists have tried to keep the lid on this, but it's been determined by those working in genetics, and they've done the human genome, and they've also run the Neanderthal genome, and they say, yes, it is a human, but not in our gene pool, not related to us. According to genetics, the Neanderthal and us are not related. Well, according to Darwinism, we descended from Neanderthal, among others, but according to genetics, we did not descend from Neanderthal. So Darwin's theory is dead.
Yeah, that's from a lot of different perspectives. I can't do everything. I'm working on the fossils, the fossil evidence, the archaeological evidence for the human species.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely there's a lot of evidence there, you know, that contradicts the theory. But I just wanted to pick up on this idea of giants, you know, mm-hmm. that you were mentioning. You're correct. There's a lot of reports of discoveries of large-sized humans. And by that, I mean humans over 9 or 10 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
As we know, there are many living humans today who are 7 feet.
Yep, they're in the NBA.
Basketball players, that's
yeah.
correct. And you can even find one or two people, you know, a couple people around the world who may be 8 feet tall. But when you get up to 10 feet, you don't see any people like that around today.
Mm-hmm.
But as you have been pointing out, as you pointed out, there have been many reports of discoveries of skeletons or bones of large-sized human beings. And I'm very interested in this. I would expect to find such things because, just even according to standard science, before 5 or 10,000 years ago, most living things were larger than they are today. The animals were bigger, the plants were bigger. For example, I live in California, and in the California mountains, the Sierra Nevadas, you've got the California redwood trees. And some of them are over 5,000 years old, and they are the biggest living things on Earth. They're holdovers, you know, from these previous times when most living things were much bigger than they are today. So I would expect that human beings were also bigger. The Bible says that. The Quran says that. A lot of traditions say that. The Vedic writings of India say that. Before 5 or 10,000 years ago, living things were bigger. So I've always been interested to see if I could find any of these large-sized human bones myself. Once I came pretty close. I had been invited by a businessman in New Zealand who liked my work to come to New Zealand and give some lectures. So I met him at the airport in Auckland. You know, I arrived at the airport in Auckland, the capital of not the capital, but the biggest city in New Zealand. And he met me at the airport. He said, tomorrow we're going to see something very interesting. He said to me, a friend of mine since childhood is one of the directors of the Auckland Museum of Natural History, and he's going to show us the bones of a human being over 10 feet tall from one of the Pacific Islands. So I thought, finally, okay, I'm actually going to see directly one of these skeletons of a large-sized human, a giant.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the museum the next morning, and the gentleman met us, and he began taking us through the museum, showing us the dinosaurs and this and that and the other. And finally we asked him, well, what about the large-sized human skeleton? He said, I'm sorry, we can't see it. So I had to think, well, what happened in 24 hours that this man had told his friend since childhood that he was going to show us the skeleton? And then when we had come there the next morning, he didn't do it. I really don't know the answer to that question. I found it very strange. Maybe he had mentioned that morning to some of his colleagues in the museum what he was going to do. They told him not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But
there seems to be...
It's an interesting topic that you brought up there. I just wanted to throw that in to kind of confirm a little bit what you were saying.
Well, there seems to be, not only about giants, but about, as we were talking, about evidence that indicates that humans walked this planet millions of years ago. There seems to be a rather orchestrated effort to keep that evidence and that information away from the public. Now, I agree that in some cases you may have a mining company that doesn't want to have to pay for that archaeological dig, and they don't want to have to stop operation, and so they just either destroy it or cover it up or whatever they do. That does, I'm sure, that does happen. There are probably cases in which someone, like the mine owner, who says, wow, this is really cool, I want these artifacts for my own secret private collection.
That's also a possibility.
Yep. But that can't account for all of it.
Well, and, as I said, I think most of it's due to this knowledge filtering process that's operating.
Yeah, but it seems to be orchestrated. It seems as if they are all in agreement that, hey, we're going to keep this quiet. And I'd like to know who is behind that, who's pulling those strings, who's orchestrating it.
Well, as I said, at this particular time in history, these people have a government-enforced monopoly in the education system. And that means only their ideas can be taught.
We have to step away again for a couple of minutes for a break. We'll pick up right there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. More with Michael Cremo. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Michael Cremo. Michael, I understand about the professional jealousy, guarding the treasures of information, so to speak, down at the Temple of Science. I understand that there is that, but this thing seems to be lockstep. You would expect that there would be some people among the ranks of the highly credentialed scientists that would step out and say, now, hang on, guys. Look, here's the deal, folks. There are these footprints that are fossilized, and they're from 600 million years ago. And so we really don't know any more about that than what I'm telling you, but obviously our timeline for evolution is wrong. I mean, you would think there would be someone among the credentialed academics in the establishment could make literally millions of dollars off of his books if he stepped out and became the crusader to lead that, and they don't do it. There's something up. It is an orchestrated thing. It's not just everyone mindlessly agrees with the data.
No, I think you're right about that, and I think where the root of the problem is that if our current theories of human origins are wrong, the alternatives tend to come from what we might call the more esoteric kinds of wisdom that would say we have an origin off this planet, we're not simply a combination of chemical elements,
genetics has stepped to the plate.
And just chemicals, there's some kind of conscious self that's come from some higher dimension of reality, there may be powers in the universe that are more powerful than we are. There may even be some kind of supreme intelligence out there that's responsible for the whole thing, which means we're not, you know, the lords of the earth as we think we are.
Well, genetics.
I think that is what the real fear is.
Well, genetics has blown them away there as well, Michael. Because the Human Genome Project discovered that we have, you and I, and all of the humans on this planet, 223 genes that have no evolutionary predecessors.
Right.
So the closed box that evolution theory requires had its lid ripped off by the Human Genome Project. It's no longer a closed box. We have 223 genes that are not from here.
Yeah, so if you've got things like that, they lead in a direction that these gatekeepers, we might call them, don't want human society to go in.
I don't call them gatekeepers. I call them intellectual mudsuckers. They're bottom feeders. They're feeding off of the dead corpse of Darwinism as a theory, and it is a dead theory.
Yes, but what it does, I mean, of course, there are some attempts to blend it in with different kinds of spirituality, but for the most part, as it's taught in the classrooms, in the science classrooms, in high schools and universities around the country, it's taught in such a way that we are made to believe that we are just purely material beings, that life came from chemicals, that we're just complex biomolecular machines that have no higher purpose than to produce and consume more and more material things.
Yeah.
And there are many forces in society, in our human society today, that would like to keep the masses of people, the hundreds and millions of people in countries around the world with their noses to the grindstone, quiet, contented, working to produce more and more material things that generate a flow of money. And where does that money go?
It goes to GM.
It goes into the hands, the pockets of scientists who are now, if you go to any university now, you see, you don't see individual scientists working in labs, you know, doing their own research. You see huge research institutes sponsored by consortiums of government, military, and the universities. Huge amounts of money pouring into these research institutes that produce pharmaceuticals, consumer products, weapons that different corporations sell. So you've got the universities getting rich off this. You've got the scientists getting rich off all of this. You've got corporations that sell the pharmaceuticals, that sell the consumer products, that sell the weapons, making billions of dollars. You've got governments taxing all of this economic activity, generating huge amounts of wealth. And if something happens in the world that causes people to cut back a little bit, to think, maybe I shouldn't be working so hard. Maybe I should take a little time for myself and my friends and my family, and they begin to cut back on their working and consuming, it causes huge shockwaves throughout the world's political and financial and scientific centers.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say yes, you say yes, there is some kind of organized attempt to keep. See, the way this really works is, you know, the goals that we set for ourselves individually and collectively are to a large extent determined by the answers to the questions, who am I, where did I come from? If we're told, you know, in our education systems that, well, we are material beings with material needs, that's all that we are, then we'll think that our main purpose in life should be to work hard to produce and consume more and more material things. Basically, that's what our whole human civilization today is based on. Now, that wasn't always true in human society. There were great societies, human civilizations in the past that were based more on developing the resource of consciousness rather than the resources of matter. They believed in using the human energy to advance human civilization in other ways. So I think today there is a nexus of scientific, political, financial, educational interest that want to keep the majority of people peacefully, quietly, and happily engaged in producing and consuming more and more material things.
Because and in order to do that, in order to accomplish that, they have to keep people peacefully and happily ignorant.
Yes. And that is one of the functions of the Darwinian theory of evolution, to keep people thinking, yes, we are just material beings who are competing with each other. Because if you can turn people against each other and keep them competing against each other for survival, which is what the Darwinian theory of evolution tells us, we are just machines made of matter competing with each other for survival. That mentality is something I believe that these powers want to keep people in. Because if they do that, they will very contentedly, peacefully work very hard producing and consuming more and more material things.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and when we come back, I want to get into how that whole Darwinian thing has moved us away from being conscious of consciousness and may have contributed to a shorter lifespan and may be contributing to lowering our quality of life. We'll be back right after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Michael Cremo. And we will open the telephone lines a little bit later, a little further down the road. We'll open up the telephone lines for you. But I want to sort of explore something with Mr. Cremo and see what you think about this. There's a big debate in psychology, and it's been raging now for many decades, still continues, over whether there is anything actually definable as the human mind, and over whether there is anything actually definable as consciousness. There are divisions among those in psychology over those issues. Now, ancient writings in many different cultures allude to what we today call consciousness. And not only allude to it, but really delve into it quite a bit. And let's assume for a moment that we are not just a collection of chemicals and biological matter. Let's assume for a moment that there is consciousness and that matter is the manifestation of consciousness. Consciousness then manifests itself in many different forms, and we are one of those forms. If that's the case, and we are taught to think that's not the case, we divorce ourselves from the very thing that is manifesting us, and therefore we shorten our lifespan and lower our quality of life. That's just a hypothesis, but what do you think about it?
I think you're absolutely right about that. This is something I get into in my most recent book, Human Devolution, A Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. We were talking about my first book, Forbidden Archaeology,
right,
in the first part of the show about, yeah, the archaeological evidence that contradicts the current theories. But then people would ask, well, if we're not just evolved apes, if we're not just, you know, combinations of chemicals, what are we and where did we come from? So I try to delve into those topics in this book, Human Devolution. And basically, what I say, drawing on knowledge that's there in the various ancient wisdom traditions of the world, is that originally we are beings of pure consciousness. That's what we are. But we become temporarily covered by matter. Today, as you were indicating in the world of psychology, most psychologists, most scientists believe that matter is the primary substance. They believe that when matter combines in a sufficiently complex manner in the brain, it produces, as a byproduct of bioelectrical activity, what we call consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But only temporarily, because they would say as soon as the matter in the brain is disorganized, that consciousness will disappear. It will no longer exist. It can only exist in connection with the brain, with the body made of matter, with the chemicals. So under that view, matter is the primary thing. And of course, if people believe that, then their goals will tend to be focused on matter, dominating it, controlling it, trying to exploit it. However, what I'm proposing, and it seems what you're proposing, is that matter isn't primary. It's consciousness that is primary. It is the ultimately real thing, and it can be temporarily covered over, you know, by matter. It can falsely identify with matter, and when it does that, it loses touch with its real self. It loses touch with its real needs. It begins to, as you say, behave in such a way that its material vehicle doesn't function properly. See, this is a key concept in what I'm proposing, is that the body that we have, the material body that we have, is a vehicle for a conscious self. It can be used for two purposes: to become more and more deeply entangled in matter, or it can be used to transcend that level, go back to the original source of all conscious beings on a level of pure consciousness. That's the actual purpose of the vehicle, but you can also use the vehicle made of matter to become more and more deeply entangled in matter. And if we do that, the vehicle is not being used for its proper function, so it's going to start misfunctioning, malfunctioning. You know, it's like if you have a vehicle and you use it in the proper way, give it the right fuel, it'll take you where you want to go. But if you misuse the vehicle, put the wrong fuel in it, it's not going to function so well. And if we're not using our human vehicle for its proper purpose, you're right, the lifespan is going to shorten. We'll be subjected to all kinds of diseases and malfunctionings of the human body, and not just individually, but also collectively also.
Well, if consciousness plays the key role, the primary role, then to the extent that we unplug from that, to the extent that we are unconscious, whether willingly or unwillingly, but unconscious of consciousness. Does that make sense? To the extent that we're ignoring that, to that extent, we're not getting the input necessary to keep this manifestation of consciousness in the order that it was intended. Now, on this show, from time to time, one of our guests is Dr. Gerald Epling. He is an expert in memory. And the first time he came on this show, he talked about memory, and he said, you know, we know just about everything there is to know about memory, except where it's stored, because memory is not stored in the brain. He said we can activate memories by activating parts of the brain, but we've been able to determine they're not stored there. So the brain, in one show he said the brain acts sort of like a CPU in the computer, the central processing unit. But where's the hard drive? We don't know where it's stored. And we started talking about this and then got into consciousness. He's done some experiments in which he's been able to prove scientifically with very sensitive technology that collects data and graphs the data. He's been able to prove that plants actually will respond to your thoughts. Now, a plant doesn't have a brain. A thought is consciousness. And so if it can respond to your thought, then it is responding at the level of consciousness.
Yes. Now here's how I deal with that topic in my book, Human Devolution. Drawing on different ancient wisdom sources, what I'm proposing is that a human being is actually made of three things. There's matter, mind, and consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And ordinary matter is what our gross physical body is made of, mm-hmm. and the chemical elements. But there's a more subtle kind of matter called mind, which actually stores the memories, and the conscious self is apart from that. So there's matter, mind, and consciousness. Those are the three elements that make up a human being or any other living thing. Now, when this body made of the gross physical chemical elements comes to an end, the conscious self will go with the subtle mental body to another gross physical body. And when the conscious self and the mind, which has stored up the memories, connect to another gross physical body, sometimes the person will remember its last body, the one it had before. So I'm a believer in reincarnation, in other words.
Well, there are many cases around the world of children, little children, you know, 4 or 5 years old, that remember a previous lifetime. They remember a different mom and dad. They remember who they were. They even remember a house and the surroundings. And, you know, it's just amazing when you look at some of the case studies on those. Because what's the explanation? There is no explanation for that within the closed box system of establishment science. So I think that what you're proposing makes sense. It certainly would account for how those little children know all those details about another life that in many cases are corroborated. So it would explain that.
Memories are stored in the mental body, which accompanies the conscious self when it leaves the gross physical body. It's you could use a computer analogy to think about this. You could compare the gross physical body of the human being to computer hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And you could compare the mind to software. And on your software, you can store things. You know, for example, you can store your Word files, you can store your pictures, and then then you can take them to another computer, and when you put that software on another computer, it will run it, and it'll install the whatever is on that software into the memory of the new computer. And then you can see the pictures that you had on the other computer. You could see the files that you had on the other computer.
Mm-hmm.
So those can be transferred from computer to computer. So I think our mind is something like that. The gross physical body is like the computer, and the mind is like software that can. Be put on some kind of storage mechanism that can...
It can be carried from computer to computer.
Yeah, from computer to computer. We do it all the time. I do that. I carry around a USB drive that's got some files and pictures on it. That means if I'm going to a conference, I can plug that into another computer. I don't have to bring my own computer, and I can call up the images or the files that I need to call up. So,
well, now you mentioned the Vedic writings. You have studied a lot of ancient documents for a number of years. In many different cultures, the ancient writings speak about consciousness, but they speak about also very real beings, very real entities, beings that come from elsewhere in this universe. Not all of them speak of that, of course, but many of them do. In some cases, they're called angels. In some cases, they're called demons. In some cases, they're not ascribed anything, any spiritual title, but they are simply the sky people or something like that. But almost all the ancient cultures talk about this civilization or these people who came from up there, and they talk about them in very real terms. They don't. It's not like they were imagining or praying to these beings whom they have never seen but assume exist. They talk about them as though they had face-to-face contact with them. Now, as you've studied all of these ancient documents, you no doubt have run into some of that. And let me get your take on that. Are these people being mythological, or are they telling us an accurate account of what they saw and heard?
Well, the accounts are there, as you say, in the ancient writings of various wisdom traditions. I've studied very deeply the Vedic writings of ancient India. There's certainly information there, but many people today just the fact that something is written about in some ancient text doesn't really mean a lot to them. They want to know, well, what evidence is there today that would lead me to believe that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings, that there are different beings existing on different levels, and they're coming back and forth, and what sort of evidence is there today that would suggest that is true? They would say, I know it. Yes, it's mentioned in these ancient writings, but what is there today? And in my book, Human Devolution, I go into several categories of evidence that would support the idea that we are part of some wider cosmic hierarchy of beings that exist in different levels of the cosmos and different regions of the cosmos. So one category of such evidence is communications from spirits of departed humans that humans on our level can receive. Another category of such evidence.
Now, do you mean a medium or electronic voice phenomena, or how are you meaning communications?
For example, there was an English physicist, who Sir Oliver Lodge, who was a very famous physicist living in the early part of the 20th century. He had a son named Raymond who was killed in World War I. And he wanted to... he loved his son very much, both his wife and him. They loved their son. They loved their child. They felt some need to try to establish some communication with the spirit of their departed son. So Sir Oliver Lodge went to a medium And he went in disguise. He didn't. He kept his identity hidden. He didn't want the medium to know who he actually was, because if his identity was revealed, then she could start doing research, dig into things, and and maybe come up with some kind of fake communications that would.
Well, we just lost your audio. I don't know what's happened. Yeah, we just lost your audio. So, are you still there?
I am still here. I can hear you.
Okay, you're back.
I'm back.
Yeah.
So, Sir Oliver Lodge approached the medium to try to reestablish contact with the spirit of his lost son. And through this medium, he was actually able to do that, and he was able to contact the spirit of his lost son. And in these communications, the spirit revealed through the medium many intimate details that would have only been known to Raymond Lodge. So that was a very interesting case that was reported by a professional scientist of communications from a spirit of a departed human being who was communicating from some other level, some other region, to our level. There are also cases of possession of bodies of human beings on our level by spirits of departed human beings. There was one case mentioned by William James, the father of modern psychology, in his book, Principles, his textbook, Principles of Psychology. So William James was an American psychologist who was working in the early part of the 20th century, and he is known as the father of modern psychology. You can look up William James in encyclopedias on the web and learn all about him. He's one of the fathers of modern psychology. But in his textbook, Principles of Psychology, he mentioned what he considered to be a genuine case of spirit possession. Now, the case was called the Watseka Wonder. Watseka is a little town in the state of Illinois. And there was a girl living in this town. Her name was Lorancy Venom. She lived with her mother and father very peacefully for many years. And then at a certain point, she started going into trance states. And in these trance states, she encountered spirits of departed humans. And one of them was the spirit of a girl named Mary Roth. And this spirit said, "I want to come back to Earth from where I am now and visit my family." So after this happened, Lorancy Venom felt like a stranger in her own house. She didn't recognize her mother or father anymore. She just kept talking about this family, this Roth family. So her parents went out, found the family, and they brought the family to the Venom house. And as they were coming up to the house, Lorancy Venom looked out and just immediately recognized them. "Oh, that's my mother, that's my sister." So both families agreed she should go and live with the Ross.
I hate to cut you off right there, but a break is taking over and our mics will go dead. We'll pick up right there when we come back on the other side of this break, and I'll open the phone lines for you folks. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Michael Cremo. Michael, before I open up the telephone lines, I want to give you the opportunity to finish that story about this Watseka wonder.
Well, that was a case of spirit possession that was included by William James, the father of modern psychology, in his textbook, Principles of Psychology. Involved a girl who was possessed by a spirit of another girl who had died a couple of years previously, a girl named Mary Roth. And when this girl, Lorancy Venom, was possessed by the spirit of Mary Roth, she went to live with the Roth family and behaved perfectly as her daughter, expressing all kinds of detailed knowledge of the family's history and intimate personal affairs that would have only been known to their departed daughter. Now, after spending several weeks with the family, she again began going into trance states, and the spirit of Mary Roth said, okay, I've visited my family, and now I'm going to go back where I came from. And when that happened, this girl, Lorancy Venom, felt like a complete stranger in the Roth house. She was very homesick for her own family, so then both families agreed she should go back to her original family, and she lived out a normal life after that. Now, the reason I was mentioning this is, and before we got to the break, we were talking about the different ancient wisdom traditions that tell that as conscious beings, we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of beings that exist in other regions of the cosmos, on other levels of the cosmos. And we were talking about how many people today simply just won't accept statements from ancient books. They want to know, well, what kind of evidence is there today from science that would lead us to believe that. So I've pointed out in my book, Human Devolution, that there are several categories of evidence that support this idea that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of conscious beings. And among the types of evidence that we could explore are communications from the spirits of departed humans. We're talking about some cases, this case of possession of the bodies of humans on this, on our level of reality, by spirits of departed humans. Then there are also apparitions of the spirits of departed humans, and there are also cases of apparitions of superhuman beings, as in the case of Marian apparitions, for example. These are visions of the Virgin Mary that have taken place in many countries throughout Europe and South America and North America. Whether it's the Virgin Mary these people are experiencing or some other type of goddess, I'm not sure. But there are very well documented cases of such apparitions. And then there's the modern UFO alien abduction type of phenomenon, and these have also been very, very well documented. So it's not that the idea that we're part of a whole cosmic hierarchy of conscious beings is something we just read about in the ancient wisdom traditions. It's also something that we can find evidence for in modern scientific research if we are open-minded enough to consider everything that scientists have actually observed and reported.
Okay, let's go to the telephone line. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hi,
great
Kevin.
Show tonight, guys.
Good.
Michael, you've done a lot of studies on ancient archaeology and whatnot, and that humans survived long ago. What has your research shown about ancient civilizations? Is there any evidence that there have been civilizations in the past that have risen and fallen, and that any kind of evidence of those has been willfully suppressed from the people?
Well, I think time is cyclical, and I believe that human civilizations have risen and fallen many times on this planet. This is something that's also there in the writings of the ancient Greek philosophers like Plato and Aristotle and things like that. A lot of the evidence that I report in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, would seem to most people to be representative of a fairly simple level of culture. You know, for example, stone tools and weapons and footprints and human bones. And sometimes people ask me, well, have things been found that are indicative of a little higher level of civilization? One interesting discovery of that sort that I documented in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, was a copper coin that was discovered in the state of Illinois in the United States in the 19th century. At this particular place called Lawn Spring in the state of Illinois, they were drilling a well, and when the well got down to about 114 feet below the surface, this copper coin-like object was brought up. And on the surface of the coin-like object was a human figure and an inscription in an unknown language. So I was, of course, interested how old this object was. Now, this is another one of those cases that was reported by an investigator working for the Smithsonian Institution. The report was published in a scientific publication, but the object is no longer to be found. However, the original drawings of it are still there in the scientific publication, and the original descriptions are still there, including a drilling record of the well boring. By drilling record, I mean a detailed account that the drillers kept, that they went down through 1 foot of sand, 2 feet of clay, 3 feet of stone and 5 feet of gravel, all the way down to the 114-foot level. So what my co-author and I did is we took this drilling record from the scientific report, and we made a copy of it, and we sent it to the State Geological Survey of Illinois, and we asked them, at this place, at the 114-foot level, how old is the layer at that level? And they told us it's between 200,000 and 400,000 years old. Now, that's pretty amazing, because that means you've got a coin coming from a layer at least 200,000 years old. And this is pretty interesting, because according to the standard theories, the first coins, the first metal coins, were invented about 3,000 years ago in a country called Lydia, which is on the coast of Turkey now, on the Aegean Sea. And now, you know, we have evidence that coins were being used in North America over 200,000 years ago. So if you have coins, that means you have some kind of civilization. That means you have some kind of developed economy. It means you have some kind of government or administrative system that is issuing the coins. So I thought that was very interesting. Now, according to the reports, near this part of Illinois, other discoveries were made at about the same level that they were ship rigging. They were metal objects that exactly resemble, you know, the kinds of metal objects you see in ship rigging, which means they had some kind of ships. If they had coins, that means they also had some kind of trade going on, some kind of government system. And so this would have been on the shores of the Great Lakes in North America, you know, between Canada and the United States.
And this also would be from about 200,000 years ago.
That's right. So that's really kind of interesting, but here again, it's one of those cases where if you try to track down the original object, the coin, you can't. It disappeared.
Yeah, the Smithsonian is pretty good about losing stuff.
Yeah.
All right.
Lost everything, but they did lose that.
Let's go back to the phone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Colin from New York. It's been a while since I've called in.
I recognize the voice, though. Welcome back. We're glad to have you.
Yeah. Very interesting show as always. I've been listening. It's not easy to call in all the time. But he said a few things tonight. Obviously the record going back further than we realize is the big issue.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about when he brought up just briefly Plato's name, the allegory of the cave came up, that we're all just chained and looking at the shadows, and we just refuse to look beyond that. While we have to, what he also was alluding to in his last statements right now is while we have to rely on science at some point to define reality as we come to terms with it, cope with it. Like you always point out, like go try and walk on water if you think things are all just spiritual. And there's obviously some issues we have to come to. I think this forbidden archaeology issue is a great thing for us to at least open our minds to this possibility of, you know, what it is we are and how enduring and how plastic we indeed are. We don't break down. We stay. We're because we are what we are, this world seems to sustain us, even though we try and harm it as much as we can, whether through intention or not.
Somehow we keep surviving the calamities.
Right, and then when we see records of this gold and the coal,
mm-hmm.
these things he's describing throughout the show, you know, there's obviously evidence of some kind of intelligence, this minted coin. That makes me think of the Mel's whole story right away.
Colin, you want to hang on through this break?
Yeah, I would like to hang on. Yeah.
All right, hang on, and we'll be back to you right after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, more with my guest, Michael Cremo, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Still on the line with us, Colin?
Yes.
All right. Go ahead with your thought.
I want to ask a question of your guest because he's much more able to speak on anything than I am. But the question is that has he heard of that Mel's Hole story? Because he spoke of a dime with a bee mint on it. Which he seemed to think indicated Berlin and that Germany had won the Second World War. And it was a fantastic story, and a lot of it just seemed to be over the top. But I was wondering if he heard of that, and because he brought up this coin that was minted so long ago. And, just to me, it just seems like that's not such a big deal, okay? You know, that we discover this, and it's this idea of forbidden in the title, which obviously... I just wonder if he's heard of that story and.
Okay, let's let him answer. What about that, Michael? Have you heard of this story of Mel's Hole?
No, I haven't, but I learn something new every day. It's one of the reasons I like coming on shows like this, where there's some interaction with the listeners. I learn new things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I say that same thing all the time, that every single show, when people call in and they have their perspective on things and their questions, I learn something that I didn't know, or I am introduced to looking at it from an angle I had not considered. But let me say this, Colin, I have heard of Mel's Hole, and it appears to be lost. No one seems to know exactly where it is now. But it is what it is, Michael, is a hole into which you can throw something and never hear it hit bottom. And a lot of anomalies around it. Colin, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Okay, we have time for one more call. If you have a question or comment for Michael Cremo, the telephone number is 480-553-7232, and we would love to hear from you if you have a question or a comment. You know, Michael, I am the least religious guy you're probably ever going to run into. That doesn't mean that I am anti-spiritual or that I am an atheist, or it's just that religion and I operate in two different worlds. Spiritual is one thing, religious is another, at least from my point of view. I'm sorry?
You're right about that.
Yeah. So, but having said that, you know, consciousness seems to me to be self-evident. I mean, the operations of our own minds can tell us that there are things above our own minds. I know there are people that would try and explain it away, but there are just so many things that are above our own minds. And I don't mean that it's knowledge that we have not yet attained. I mean there is a level above the mind that is in operation that from time to time we can consciously detect. And but it sort of works like this. Last year, or maybe it was early this year, I had as my guest Dr. Michio Kaku, whose textbooks on quantum physics are in every major university in America. And he was talking about laws of physics, and I said to him, he's a great open-minded person, and I said, but Dr. Kaku, isn't it true that there really are no laws of physics? What we're calling laws of physics really are just descriptions of our current understanding. And some smart guy is going to come along like Einstein did and step right over one of those so-called laws of physics, just like Einstein stepped right over Newton's laws of motion. And then we'll have a whole new understanding of how things work, and what we thought was a law, we will see then that we were in error. And his response was, absolutely. He said, that's absolutely correct. That will happen. And what we call laws of physics really are just our descriptions of the way we think things work. Now, having said that, and you apply it to what we've been talking about, you see, the Darwinians have outlined the way they think things work, and yet there is scientific discovery that has stepped right over their laws of evolution. And in stepping over those, it has proven that this is not a closed box like evolution says it is, and that there is room for and probably evidence of outside intervention. And that being the case, then I think the argument for consciousness being primary and matter being an expression or a manifestation of consciousness, I think that makes a lot more sense. And it would seem to me, and here's what here's where I've been heading with this. It would seem to me then that if we start from that position, we will make greater scientific discoveries and progress than if we start at the closed box position.
I agree with you 100% on that. You know, you were talking about kind of evidence that the consciousness can receive inputs. You know, there are some researchers who have studied the phenomenon of inspiration. And many great scientists have noticed this. They'll be contemplating some problem. They'll be agitating their minds, their intelligence about it, but they just cannot break through. They cannot get the answer. They cannot solve the problem. And it just goes on for days and weeks, and they're just not able to manipulate their own minds and intelligence in such a way that they can solve the problem that they're working on. But then they notice that somehow or other they get a flash of inspiration that seems to come from some higher level or something like that that mm-hmm. solves the problem for them. It may be some vision, it may be some dream, it may be, you know, there was a case from the history of chemistry, the chemist Kekulé, who was trying to solve the problem of the carbon atom, the hydrocarbon molecule, what was its shape? And it just came to him in a vision, like a serpent, a flaming serpent eating its tail. And he realized from that the structure of the hydrocarbon molecule is circular.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, and that proved out to be true. It was a great, brilliant, you know, insight that he had, but it wasn't something he was able to just figure out by agitating his brain.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that came from some other level, and composers like Mozart, for example, he spoke about how he was inspired because he wrote these beautiful symphonies, but he didn't put them together piece by piece. He said, I would be out, you know, on a ride in a park or something. The whole thing would come just fully manifested mm-hmm. in my mind, and then I would just sit down and write it out.
Well, and Nikola Tesla, many of his inventions, he visualized the whole thing as if he were watching a movie. And then he would begin to draw it on paper and turn it into blueprints. You know, I wasn't watching the clock, and we've reached the end of the show. Michael, I want to thank you for being with us. If you will, stay on the phone with me for just a moment.
Okay.
All right. Wow, folks, there you have it. It's been a great week here at The Kevin Smith Show. Next week is going to be a great week as well, and I hope you'll be with us for every show. If you miss a single second, you're going to miss a universe of information. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.